Welcome to the Sean Chandler Podcast, a place to talk movies and nerd culture way too much. Joining me, as always, is Griffin Schiller. Griffin, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing well. And for the record, I am not a soy boy, so we're going to go with that. That's going to be my opening.
What an interesting way to start off the show. Also, fun things to start off the show, two gigantic corporations decided to go to war with one another last night. So that's an awful lot of fun to kind of, for a podcast like ours, to have them decide to do that as of recently. But everybody, as you're tuning in, this is being recorded live to YouTube. So if you listen to the audio version later on from time to time, we will take in some user chats. And if you want to be a part of that experience, it happens Wednesdays around noon on my YouTube channel. And if you guys are in the live stream right now, be sure to tell your thoughts on whatever topics we are talking about, and we'll do our best to respond to any super chats that come in, especially if they are on topic. We got a bunch of stuff to talk about today. The big thing, Trolls World Tour turns out to be this massive, gigantic game changer for the industry. Of all movies to do that, Trolls World
Tour. Who would have thought?
Yeah. Yeah, it's legitimate. Who would have thought? It January 1st, the movie that was going to cause a gigantic stir and AMC theaters banning Universal Pictures, Trolls 2, of course. What other movie? So apparently a big, gigantic, massive hit. CEO made some statements that were not well received by AMC theaters. We're going to talk all about that and the ramifications of it all. More movie dates have been swapping around. We'll cover that pretty quickly. We talk about that stuff every week, so I don't want to spend too much time on it. Also, the Oscars are changing up their policies for just this year. A little bit of a change up, and so that they're going to allow more streaming options in all of this. And then also I want to do a little editorial on action movies at the end of this, because I've been having a bunch of conversations on Twitter that have just kind of been heartbreaking to me a little bit over the response to Extraction. Not that I think everybody should love the movie, but the specific response has been not exactly the one that I would have hoped for. But real quick, before we start diving into our topics, if you're listening to an audio version, be sure to like, rate, all of that fun stuff. If you're on the live stream, click that like button, leave a comment in the chat, trying to get as much momentum on this thing as is possible. And let's get started with our first topic of the day. And that is, as of yesterday, Universal, NBC, CEOs started actually revealing just how good Trolls 2 did. We talked about this a couple of weeks back on the podcast where we knew it did great, but we weren't sure if that was like astounding numbers or just great numbers, especially for that particular movie given the circumstances. CEO comes out and basically says this thing has made $100 million from rentals in 2 weeks. It's doing better than the one that was released in theaters. And then the troublesome statement, he said, when theaters reopen, we're looking to release films on streaming still, both platforms. So let's start right here. What do we make of it now that we kind of know this streaming option, it's working. It's the real deal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess the other side of that, is that just a product of our time? Our literal quarantine time, is it a product of that?
No, it's not just a I think the situation we're in kind of like forced the like pushed the needle a little bit into that direction. But I don't know why this is like such a crazy and weird idea, because like studios have been doing this for years. That's what straight to VOD movies are. And look, it's not like they're going to be dropping Jurassic World, Minions, whatever, like Sing 2. It's not like they're going to be dropping those on VOD, right? Like, they're going to drop the big money makers in theaters. They're just mainly talking about like films that probably wouldn't have done as well at the box office that now have a chance. And because they're not, splitting profits with the theaters, they retain all of that income. So it's like, of course, a movie like Trolls 2 is going to do better on VOD than it is in theaters. And yes, the time we're currently living in probably helped it out a little bit more. But like, it makes sense to me. Like, maybe some, middle tier, smaller family movies like Scoob, for instance, even though that's Warner Brothers, but it's like, that's perfect for VOD because like, to get the whole family out to go to the theaters, like, well, yes, it's great for big event movies. It's really difficult. And I'm sure you can attest to it, like with everyone and like just getting popcorn and getting snacks and making sure everyone's like settled down and quiet. If you can do all of that at home for like a new family movie or a new animated movie, like, why not? And as we'll get into with AMC's reaction, I think it's, well, I see where they're coming from. It's ridiculous to assume that their Universal is just completely upending the theater system, you know?
Right. Well, and I get to take my kids to press screenings and stuff like that. And so I take them to the theaters more than most people because it doesn't cost me money. And so when we have those movies where it is like, oh, I'll take the whole family and I had to buy tickets opening night. And so then it was the whole family. I mean, wife, kids, let's get popcorn. And it was one of those moments when, oh yeah, this is why other people don't do this. This is really expensive. I mean, it just adds up so fast when it's that many tickets and then popcorn for everybody. And so I think and the other side to it is also home technology has grown light years over the last 20 years from like the year, I don't know what, like 1960 until the year 2000, TVs were kind of the same. They got a little bit bigger, but you had color TVs come in the 1960s, and they were about the same resolution for a long time. And then we started getting higher definition TVs. And you think DVD technology was the top of the game until 13 years ago. DVD quality was what you could get at home. And over the last 15 years, when you switch to Blu-rays and it's high definition, and then you can get an HD TV for, $500 now, and not a small one. The deals for Black Friday last year, I was like, man, do I need to get a 65-inch 4K TV for $400 to put right over here in my living room? And when you can have that high of quality just at your home, that it's home theaters are competition for theaters now. You lose the community aspect to it, but there's also some pluses to it, and it doesn't cost a lot of money. So people are weighing all of that, and I think more and more people are discovering that sort of situation. And then, of course, having a couple years now of Netflix and some other people putting out quality content where we get a little bit more used to seeing a Chris Hemsworth, a Scorsese movie at home – it starts to rewire our brains and our expectations a little bit. But I think the test that is right now, it really is opening up so many doors and opportunities for stuff to happen. So that'll lead us into the second half of this, which is AMC's response. So some people in the chat were asking like, hey, why is AMC not showing Universal movies? So one of the very high ups, NBC Universal CEOs, says, when theaters reopen, we're going to play movies on both. We're going to open them on both without, that's just a statement that was made. So AMC, from their perspective, they have long-term agreements with Universal, with studios, as to having a window of time before these big releases go from, they play in the theater for so long and then they're released on home video. And there's these long negotiations for what that looks like and all sorts of how many screens. I mean, it's very complex negotiations for all of this. And then I guess a month back, six weeks back, when Universal was making their plans to release Trolls 2 directly to video and skip theaters, they sent a letter to AMC theaters where they said, because of these unusual times, we're going to put some of these movies direct onto VOD. And that's what they told the theater that. And so suddenly the CEO comes out and says, when theaters reopen, we're going to keep doing this. That's a little bit of the context, the backstory of why they're angry about this. So people ask me, what is VOD? VOD is video on demand, releasing it straight to home video, as opposed to in theaters, straight to streaming. That's what VOD is these days. And so that's the context of AMC having such a sharp, sudden response where it's like instantly, as soon as the day that the CEO of Universal makes these statements, AMC has a quick response. It's because from their perspective, you guys just violated good faith negotiations. You guys violated what you just said. And so AMC publicly stated, we will not be showing any Universal movies moving forward. That's F9. That's Jurassic World 3. I mean, that's like these are billion-dollar club movies. These are safe bets. These are big theatrical films. These are like those are the types of movies that people go out to the theaters to see. They're designed for. Like I rewatched. I'm way more excited to watch a Fast and Furious movie in the theater than I am with a crowd of people pumped up than I am sitting at my home.
Mm.
And AMC says they're out, and they elaborate a little bit. This isn't like directly towards Universal. Any studio that makes statements like this that violates our long-term negotiations and doesn't respect the window is out. So that's kind of trying to give kind of the broader picture of where they're coming from. The other piece, broad picture in this that makes it weird, we're talking about just 2 weeks ago, AMC's on the verge of going bankrupt. What negotiating do they have to make a statement like this?
Yeah. And actually, prior to that, when Universal announced that Trolls was going to open on VOD, they're like, this is an utter betrayal and we won't forget this. It's like I see both sides of it. But I think in this case, AMC's reaction is just it's such a gross overreaction. Like, really, you're not going to show F9, Minions, Jurassic World? Like, outside of Disney, Universal arguably has the biggest money makers. So you're just going to just say, nope, screw that. We're going to be petty and we're not going to play whatever game you're making us play because you decide to release some movies on VOD, which is studios do that anyway. Why is that? Like, it's not like they're saying we're going to scrap the theatrical experience altogether. Like, it's just absolutely petty and stupid. Now, I understand that they're trying to protect the theatrical experience, you know, and like, and you know, basically stay in business. But like, to make these comments right when you're on the verge of bankruptcy just shows everything wrong about the leadership in your company, in my opinion, you know?
I'll kind of play a little bit of the other side to it of the NBC Universal CEO making statements like that publicly. That's not wise. Like that, I mean, it's one of those, as much as you want to be like, AMC, what are you thinking? You also have to be like, Universal, like what are you thinking making comments like that to where have long-term negotiations they're very much like, hey, we're in a position of power. We're going to keep doing this. And they said it publicly.
I don't know if I took it like that, though. Like, it just felt like they were just out of like a shareholders meeting. They were just after like a budgetary financing meeting. And they just spoke to the Wall Street Journal, which is like a monetary, you know, magazine or like, you know, news source. So it's like, why should they not say that? Right. Like, it's just talking about releasing some movies on VOD while still preserving the theatrical experience for the movies that it really matters. You know, like, you're going to tell me that that AMC is not going to play Halloween Kills when theaters opens back up during October. Really? Like, come on, guys.
Right. I mean, that's right. That's one of these stories. I guess that's the other side of the story of where I don't really believe this is fully going to play out this way.
No, I mean,
they're going to figure something out. When you think through the way, like how complex these negotiations are, and there's certain key things in the relationship between movie theaters and production companies that there's a couple things in there that are just kind of like those sacred relationships. Like the deal breaks on this thing. And there's constantly going all the way back since home video came about, this debate over that window of time. Like when I was growing up, movies didn't come out for rental for 9 months. It was 9 months.
Yeah.
And when they came out for rental, to buy a copy of the movie, it cost $100. So Blockbuster would get a bunch of copies, but if you wanted to buy a copy, it was $100 because they didn't want you to be able to buy the movie yet. And then rental companies rental places got their window. And then at a year mark, then you could buy the movie for $30. So they cost the same amount back then as they do today with all the inflation, everything else has happened. And the they just keep shrinking that down to it's more and more towards home-based, more and more towards home-based. And so the theater experience keeps getting shrunk. And that's one of those things that people mini rabbit trail here. A lot of times people talk about, biggest box office of all time. And they want to talk about, yeah, well, Endgame might be the top one. But ticket sales, Gone with the Wind has sold more tickets. Well, if you look
yeah.
at and when what you have to think about, though, is that Gone with the Wind, for its first 40 years of existence, you could only see it in the theater or like once per year on television. You couldn't have a home copy of it. And so this home video discussion, movie theaters are battling this for like what to do with this because they just see the end of their extinction. So then when Universal goes, hey, we found a way to make more money. We can actually make more money. And so kind of they make this statement just kind of casually coming out of a meeting to the Wall Street Journal. It's not meant to be this overthought press release as to what Universal can do in the future. It is an off-the-cuff statement, most likely. But at the same time, it's an off-the-cuff statement that ties to something that's an extreme insecurity of movie theaters.
And well, that's the thing. It's like AMC is just showing how insecure they are about this whole thing. I mean, it's like how it's just like a bad relationship where someone's putting all of their insecurities on the other party, and it's not going to end well.
No.
I wonder how this affects people with A-list going forward. Like, if this thing does happen for like the rest of the year, I bet they lose a lot of A-list subscribers and everyone switches over to like Regal or whatever, which actually sucks for us out here because most of the theater chains in like Southern California where I am are AMC. Yeah. I mean, like, thankfully I have a Regal nearby me, but like AMC is the big AMC has a theater on Universal City Walk.
Yeah, that's right. It's true.
Are you just not going to show Universal's movies outside of their theme park and like near the studios? Like, they really did not think this through when they made that statement.
And so, like, I had some people talking about this because, I'm friends with a lot of people in the horror community. So since Halloween is part of Universal, that's the big movie for this huge group of people. So there's a big discussion. Yeah. Is this going to hurt Halloween? And some others like, no, there's other movie theater chains. And that's where I responded back. Like, there's like major player cities that are dominated by AMC. Only two AMC theaters in Austin. Or three now. Another one just opened. There's only three in Austin. So I'm totally unaffected by this announcement. But like when I went to go visit you in L.A., there is literally an AMC theater everywhere. And literally when you walk into Universal Studios, the theme park, the first thing you see is an AMC theater. Like, it's right there in front of you. And so, there's markets that absolutely – this is a big deal for the city of L.A., for Burbank, for Hollywood, trying to see movies being made by Hollywood. It gets really interesting.
Yeah. I don't think this is actually going to happen. No. It's just really stupid because you know what Universal could do? They could just like scrap the AMC name, scrap the theater and just make it their own theater. Right. And then they can just show movies there. It can be Universal's movies. Maybe they strike deals with other companies. And then because of how, you know, petulant AMC is kind of like acting, they could just like, you know, eliminate them altogether by saying, well, you know, screw you. We're going to have this be our own Universal Cinema and we're going to play our movies here and also decide to maybe strike deals with other studios as well. I don't know. And the question is like, you know, what are other studios going to decide to do this as well? Like, I understand Universal has been the big one to like make, you know, the move to VOD and whatnot. But like, I don't know. Again, I understand like the theaters trying to protect their like, you know, stay alive basically during these like difficult times, and like being on the verge of bankruptcy definitely makes them seem more desperate. But like, this is not the response, right? Like, you just, let's be honest. I think that the theater chains need the studios more than the studios need the theater chains.
Right.
If I'm like, realistically.
Right. Well, I mean, theaters, they only have one source of material to show, the studios. Yeah. And studios have countless options, revenue streams. The demand for new movies is not going to go away. That, like, people always want that.
Yeah.
And they'll find a way to watch that. And there's demand for a theater experience, but that's one of many sure. ways that we consume. And so theaters are much more in a vulnerable position. And so AMC making such a bold statement. I mean, even last week as I was putting together my video on five perfect movies and thinking through that, the number of potential options that were Universal. I mean, they really are massive yeah. powerhouse that you're insane to like pick a fight with them that you can't win.
Yeah. And I agree with that. And I think the last thing I'll say about this is that had to do with it is a symbiotic relationship, yep. obviously. Mm-hmm. And like the studios need to get their films in front of as many people as possible. And they can't possibly just like build theater chains across the country. But, from AMC's perspective, like the studios have really made it difficult on them. Like they've strangled. It's why ticket prices have gone up. It's why like the price of concessions have gone up, because that's how they make their money, right. because of the studios are kind of like taking a larger yes. cut. And I guess the thing is like that whenever they've done that, the theaters have always agreed mm-hmm. to that. But now it's like when the theaters are in a difficult spot, it seems like the studios are just abandoning them, yeah. you know?
That's the side to it that I see.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like I understand that mentality, but like being in a position where they are, and they definitely don't have the upper hand in this instance, and just making really just wild, outrageous remarks like that, that's not only going to that's going to hurt them in the long run, it's not good.
Right.
So it's like they got to figure a better approach out to this instead of just being ticked off because they're not treating you the way you treated them.
Yeah. Right. And hopefully they can resolve this behind the scenes. Okay, real quick, I had something that came up actually this morning that I didn't put in my show notes, but I wanted to make sure that we talked about this. I'm almost certainly going to mispronounce his name, but because I got to announce this morning that Irfan Khan passed away. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you know if I pronounced his name right?
Or do you? Yeah, I think that's pretty close. Okay. Yeah, if not right. Yeah.
So he was in Jurassic World. That's probably the broadest thing for my audience that you would be aware of, the kind of the owner guy that flew the helicopter. And yeah. He was also Slumdog Millionaire, Bollywood. He was in his early 50s, and I believe he died mm-hmm. of cancer. And so, of course, yeah. that's always a tragedy. And just kind of want to pause real quick to make sure that was brought up. Yeah. You know, it's something that's literally broke this morning since I messaged you last night about topics for the day. So mm-hmm. Have you seen much of his work beyond?
I haven't. Sadly, like Bollywood is a area or like, it's a genre of film that I haven't really gotten the chance to delve into too much. But like from my understanding, he was like one of the best, like well regarded actors to come out of Bollywood. Hence why he made the crossover right. into, you know, mm-hmm. International cinema.
Right.
I was actually just watching the Amazing Spider-Man movies, and like he was in the first one. So like I remember him from that. It's like, yeah, I remember him from small, more international driven films. But obviously his legacy lives on throughout his Bollywood filmography.
Right.
That's really like where you can get a nice taste of his work.
Yeah, and so for me, once again, like I've only seen kind of the big mainstream stuff he's done with Hollywood and Bollywood, something I keep meaning to watch Three Idiots while I'm in quarantine. And people keep asking me mm-hmm. about it. I keep meaning to. It just hasn't quite happened yet. But wanted to pause for a little bit and pay a little bit of tribute to him.
Oh, yeah. He was people are in the chat are saying he was Pi. He was the adult version of Pi in Life of Pi.
OK,
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Moving along to our next subject of the day. The Oscars put out an announcement yesterday with a couple of big important things. One of them is a temporary change and one of them is a long term one. First big change is that they said that for this year only, they're going to allow streaming services to be considered for the Oscars. And I'll elaborate on that in just a second. Second one is that they're combining sound editing and sound mixing into a single category. And so that's just, instead of having two kind of things where we talk about sound, there's just one. So diving into that first one a little bit on when it says that they're going to allow movies from streaming to be considered for Best Picture, you might immediately say, wait a minute. What about Roma? What about The Irishman? So basically, to be eligible for the Oscars, my understanding is that you need to play in a certain number of theaters in New York, in LA, for like 2 weeks. You have to actually show in a theater, those two cities, for a certain amount of time to be eligible. You have to have an actual theatrical release, and it's really specific the way it works. So you can't just like show it to your mom and pop in, you know, some random theater in Boulder, Colorado, and be like, hey, look, my mom saw it in the theater, so it's eligible.
Yeah.
And the Oscars, the Academy, have stuck to this, even as of recently, where we're getting a lot more kind of prestige level filmmakers putting out content on streaming services. And but this year, and they specified in the announcement, for this year only, we're going to open that up and streaming movies are eligible. From my perspective, in the year 2020, it just sounds a bit like the Academy's behind the times. And if you're going to make an exception for 1 year, you're kind of acknowledging times are changing. And so it just seems like they're delaying the inevitable, as opposed to really solving whatever their fear is. I'm not quite sure exactly what their fear is on it. What has to be a theatrical release. So I'm not quite sure what that is, or if it's just trying to narrow down the selection, but it seems like this is a direction, of course, they should be moving in light of all the conversations that we're having. And even the one that we just literally had about Universal being like, yeah, I mean, it looks like we're just going straight to video with some of this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, for this year, I get it. I totally understand. I think that it was kind of a no-brainer that was going to happen. I get what you're saying, but I also think that, like, if a film wants to be eligible for the Academy Awards, it should screen in, you know, theaters. It should have to do that, because that's how you get – that's how you truly – in my opinion, that's how you're truly able to appreciate the craft. It's how you're truly able to appreciate the sound, for instance, the picture quality. You get – you know, you're not distracted all the time by like whatever's going on around you. It's just like you sitting there and focusing on a film. So like, I think it should be required that like films have to screen, and it's only 2 weeks. Like it's not like it's asking for the world. Like, and if anything, it'll introduce like more people to your movie who like enjoy going to the film, or like maybe just walked up to the theater and like didn't even know your movie was playing, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh wow, that sounds interesting, let me go check that out. So I don't know, I get it, but I also think that like there is something important about seeing like films that are honored for like the highest award they can possibly achieve. Like there is something about that that's like, well, they should be seen in a theater because that's how they were designed to be seen. So like it makes sense for an award ceremony that would be one of their requirements.
And
so I don't necessarily think they're behind the curve, you know?
When the requirements are it's literally just two cities and that it's 2 weeks and it all you have to do is meet these technical requirements to be eligible for it, that's where it starts to get weird for me. Because it's like, okay, yeah, of course we're going to let in The Irishman that, you know, even Scorsese's making pretty clear this movie's meant to be seen on the big screen, but it's streaming because they're the ones that gave him money to do it. But how many people actually had the ability to see that one on the big screen outside right. of two cities? And that's where I go, okay, if we're saying that, then do we need to like fully embrace that? Do they really need to go on and say that this movie needs to show in 500 theaters in at least 10 markets? Something like that, to where it's a legitimate version of that takes place where people actually can go see the movie, as opposed to, yeah, I mean, if you're in the two most prominent cities in the United States, you can see these prestige films on the big screen. Otherwise, sure. It's not. I think that's to where like it's hard for me in Central Texas to fully buy into that one, because it's like, yeah, well, some of these ones I can't. And so should we just say Netflix movies are out because they're only meeting the technical requirements? Well, then you're kicking out Roma, you're kicking out The Irishman. That's where it, to me, it's like there's a tension there that I don't think has been figured out.
Right. And I definitely understand that. I think some of them, when I still lived in Maryland, I was really close to DC. I was able to go see a lot of those films in the independent theaters there. So it's like, you're right. You do have to live like in a metropolitan area. But I will say this, the majority of the voting body for the Academy is in New York and LA. And that's ultimately what it's about. Unfortunately, it's like, while we want everyone to see these movies, for voting purposes, it is the people right. who make up the Academy that are the ones that matter ultimately when it comes to these requirements. So it's like, it's important to see these films in a theater, but like, when your Academy voting body is in New York and LA, that's where it matters most that you have your films open for. So that's probably the only reason I can think of why it's not like a stricter requirement to be across the country, you know? Yeah. Well, and then plus, like, for some of these streaming services, it's a lot harder to get their films into theaters, like in every single state or stuff like that, because the theater chains, once again, as we were talking about, are all about like profits and making money and whatnot. And when they're already being like, when they already have a stranglehold on mm-hmm. them by the major studio system, it's harder for them to allow these smaller movies to go in when they're not the ones that are bringing in as much money, and they're almost like losing money on them, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's even, I mean, there have been many times where some of these smaller movies have gotten little releases around me, and I head out to the theater thinking, oh, it's only playing in this one theater, it'll probably do pretty. Nope. There's nobody there.
Yeah.
I mean, much the market these days for who goes to the movie theaters, it is that top percent of large films are what get the tickets. I think some of that's all to where it feels there's all these different factors could kind of play into it, to where when you have the politics of, can you even get your movie shown in a theater? We all know that we are getting prestige stuff on Netflix. That's where I mm-hmm. go. Is there a way that they need to reevaluate this? Is there a way I don't even know what I'm proposing right now, but, you know, cut a deal with the theaters that once movies are nominated for Best Picture, that they get that playing in theaters in January and February.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's some other version to it, but when you start really seeing Scorsese making his way to Netflix, and they're the ones that are funding his stuff, and the, mm-hmm. they're just doing kind of these, they're having to cut deals just so it meets minimum requirements. That's where I go, okay, we shouldn't be having movies meeting the bare minimum to qualify. We need to really think through what we're talking about with movies that obviously are kind of at that prestige level to be considered. The other one on here,
that's probably true. Yeah.
Was that they're taking sound editing and mixing and combining them into one. I think I know the difference between the two, but mm-hmm. I'm not entirely sure. To the average person, sound is sound, and seems pretty specific to have two different categories for sound mixing. So the idea of taking sound mixing and sound editing, sound editing would be the actual coming up with the sounds itself, I believe, and the mixing is the literal mix. Would that be?
Yeah.
Do you understand?
Yeah. I mean, it's like mixing in the audio with the rest of the picture. And then editing is like splicing up the audio to lay it on the track. And then also, you're right, coming up with the sounds and finding them and you know, working with Foley and stuff like that. So it's like I understand people's perception where it's just like, it's like sound is sound, but like, exactly. They're two very different jobs, and they both deserve to be recognized, in my opinion, because they both do very different things. So while I get it from like a show standpoint, it's kind of unfair to those who have worked really hard on like a movie, like, say, I don't know, Ford v Ferrari, like, and you clearly have two incredibly talented sound teams there who did two very different things. And should be like acknowledged for doing different things, not just, well, here's the sound award, you know?
Yeah.
So, because I mean, we honor like every other like respective category. Like, we honor musical score and like a best original song. We honor you know, costume design and the makeup and hairstyling, where it's like, well, we could combine those into one category and just make, I don't know, whatever they would want to call it. So it's like, while I understand, I also just think it's unfair to like single out sound, you know, and just be like, well, you don't deserve to have your two respective categories recognized.
I think the where it gets tricky is that we recognize a lot of things, but then there's things we don't recognize, like stunt work. People literally die doing that work, and it's not recognized.
Yeah.
And so then when you go, we don't recognize these guys that clearly there's an art to it. They're doing, having to figure out how to do incredible things with their life on the line. But we're also going to distinguish between the guy stepping on the glass and the guy mixing the glass into the sound of the movie. And it seems like, wait a minute. I mean, I guess maybe the guy stepping on the glass could get some in his foot, but literally this guy jumped off a building. And you know, every 3 months we hear a story about a stuntman dying, stuntwoman dying. Deadpool 2 had a lady died making that movie. And I think that's a little bit where we, I don't know if it's a fairness argument, but it's that's the one to me where I can balance it out and be like, okay, this thing is unfair. There's like, you know, I think best original song for the most part is a very weird category that gets a disproportionately large amount of time for the ceremony. And then that's where you start reevaluating. Should we have some of these? Do they need to rethink a little bit how they do a little bit of this? But that's more what I'd be coming from of like, there's motion capture doesn't seem to be properly recognized. There's certain things like where it's like these newer technologies that they haven't figured out what exactly to do with it yet. And then at the same time, once again, you know, sound is split in two. And
I get it when you say that. Yeah.
And right. But also to your point of like, those are two different, it's sound, but it's entirely different skill sets and things that you're doing. But I mean, I think that's where a lot of these categories came about
decades ago,
and the whole industry is totally different. The process of making movies is totally different, and need to reevaluate some of that.
Right. I think for me, if they're going to combine the sound categories, then they need to add like a stunt performance category. Yeah. Like I, regardless of whether they combine the two sound categories or not, it's just, it's absolutely ridiculous that they have not made that a category, especially because it's like, it's not anything new. It's just like, we're really starting to appreciate it now because of how insane the choreography and the work is. But like, That thing's been around for ages, and it's really been a huge part of what makes movies movies. So it's like, yes, that should absolutely be recognized. Then the other one, like with motion capture, I think if an actor gives like as good of a motion capture performance as Andy Serkis did in War for the Planet of the Apes, they should be considered for a Best Actor nomination, because that is literally them. Like, it is no different than putting on makeup. So there are a few barriers that the Academy definitely has to get over and get with the times, you know.
So moving along, we got a couple super chats come in. Oliver said, hey, this is probably the best video I could have woken up to today. Love these podcasts. Well, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. And these are actually a lot of fun to do, especially now that they're live and we can interact back and forth with the chat section and everything like that. It becomes kind of this weekly deal where we're all kind of in quarantine and we're just sitting around talking about movies, what interests us and everything kind of going on in the world, which is fun. So they're fun for me. Real quick little topic. They announced yesterday that Now You See Me 3 is in production. Or not in production, is in development. The development means they're working on the script behind the scenes, hiring people for it. In production means you're filming. Post-production means that you're editing, special effects, sound, stuff like that. So they announced that it is in development. They are planning on doing Now You See Me 3. Fun fact, before Sean Chandler talks about, I posted a bunch of reviews on, not a bunch, some reviews on the same exact YouTube channel. One of those being Now You See Me, where a buddy of mine got me into the press screening for it. And so I was like, hey, I might as well just shoot a review for this. So if you want to see prototype Sean Chandler movie review, you can see Now You See Me, the original one. I never actually watched the second one. So I didn't like the first one that much. I didn't really dislike it. It just kind of was. I thought it was a little bit too fantastical for what could have been a really interesting idea of what if magicians were trying to do heists using actual magician tricks rather than, no, that's just magic. Like, you can't do that. So that's where it kind of lost me a little bit. But never saw the second one. I heard about this one because my wife goes, did you hear about Now You See Me 3? They're doing a third one. I was like, did you like the first one? Oh, not really. Did you see the second one? No. So why are you getting all excited about the third one? I don't understand what that was. Anyway, what do you think about the Now You See Me movies? and this announcement.
I love, love, love the first one. I think it's very, but I think it's underrated for sure. I get the criticisms of it, but it's just such a fun movie and such like a unique and interesting idea. And the cast is great. I never saw the second one.
And that's the weird thing.
Enough,
it's one of those movies that falls into that category. Cause I'm probably more negative on the first one than you were, but it wasn't like I didn't actively dislike it or anything, but neither one of us saw the second one. That's where I'm interested that whatever that thing is, there was a disconnect. Was like, that was a cool one-time experience, but do I need a second? Do I don't even watch the second one? That's weird. That's so specific to both of us. And I think a lot of people fall in that category. And that's where I'm also like, a third one? Who saw the second one?
Yeah, it's like, what really? You're going forward with the third one? I mean, sure. I don't know. I heard the second one wasn't very good, even by like standards of the first one. So like, and I don't remember who did the second one. Was it like John M. Chu or was it I don't know who it was, but like, yeah, anyways, I loved the first one, never saw the second one. Third one, I don't know what the story is going to be, so maybe. But like, I guess I'm one of the people who's just like perfectly content.
John M. Chu,
just the first one. Yeah. And that was before he hit like his stride with Crazy Rich Asians. I've just never been a big fan of his. He's just not that great. I mean, he can do some visually interesting things, but he's just very, his stuff is very much rooted in like camp and cheese. And I just can't, it just gets to be too much at times. But yeah, I don't know. Third one, we'll see. I'm not like against it, but I'm also like not jumping out of my chair for it. And this is coming from someone who loves the first one. So
yeah, it just seemed so out of blue. Of the things to announce Tuesday, Now You See Me 3. Okay, interesting enough. All right, got a super chat real quick from Azim the Dreamer Reviews. Hey guys, I've always wondered, what sort of value do you think our channels as reviewers bring to the table? Filmmakers ultimately have the hardest job. So the question is, what is the value of movie critics and movie discussion? And I like, from my perspective, what I've always been about is I'm just interested in having the conversations that I'm either having in real life or the conversations I wanted to have in real life and bring them to the internet. It's not about am I adding a bunch to the world of film in any sort of like, you know, arrogant fashion like that. This is, I just sit around talking movies with people. This is the stuff I'm interested in. When I had interns, I'd sit them down in a corner and be like, you guys, what's your favorite John Williams score? And they're like, who's John Williams? Haven't you guys seen the Harry Potter movies? Yeah, yeah, that's him. And like that's the stuff I've always done. And I just bringing that passion, that love to the internet. And I happen to be on Rotten Tomatoes now, but that's because someone applied for me and I got accepted, which is awesome. It's amazing. But from my perspective, I perceive of myself not as a film critic and in deep analysis or anything like that. I'm just a fanboy with an audience. That's my perspective on what kind of my place is. We talked about recently, like 30 seconds ago on here. This is just about like having the conversations we want to have. And we read all these announcements. Yeah. We had some arguments on Twitter, but actually having a conversation about it. How about you? What's your
thoughts on that? Yeah. I think that it's a symbiotic relationship. And I'm not talking about myself, but I'm talking about film criticism filmmaking in general. It is a symbiotic relationship where both art forms are valid and important in their own right. Obviously, the filmmakers are the people making the movies. But when it comes to film historians, film critics, they're about the preservation of culture and bringing, you know, thoughtful analysis to pieces of art and allowing us to view it in a way that we haven't thought of before. You know, some of the best filmmakers love film critics and they love like delving into movies to explore their importance and whatnot. And so while it's really easy to write off criticism as just like, well, you're just making statements about like movies and like what you're not actually making the movies. The good critics, they're the people who really make the difference in their thoughtful approach to what they're saying. And it's all about, culture. It's all about writing about how it pertains to the world around us, how certain films, affect certain groups of people, giving, different groups of people a voice and whatnot. It is, it's important, and I think it doesn't. I think it gets overlooked quite a bit. Good film critique, really good film critique is powerful and important, and it can be life changing. It can change the way you view a movie. So and that's where it kind of gets into the fact where it's like, oh, you have just a bunch of people saying like, oh yeah, that movie was really good. That's not film criticism. That's just like people talking, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's like when you're looking at actual like film critics and people who like explore and research and preserve these works for like a living, and they do it for years, like that's what makes the difference. And it helps inform the filmmakers as to like what people are interested in, and how they can tailor their filmmaking style and their voice to, you know, the world around them.
So a really interesting one on even that kind of idea, they're just practical value to filmmakers. So the Russo brothers were on Screen Junkies like 5 years ago, and they did a guest like commentary reaction to the Captain America Winter Soldier Honest trailer. And in it, the Russo brothers said, yeah, we'd seen many of the Honest trailers before we made Winter Soldier, because it was funny, and we came from a comedy background doing TV. And so we just loved that form of criticism. And as we were making the Winter Soldier, we were actively thinking, how do we Honest trailer proof this movie? And so that's, you think Honest trailers, that's, it's film criticism, comedy, it's meant to entertain. But at its core, they're trying to actually make real observations about the contrivances and things inside of films. Likewise, like with pitch meetings recently, there's a lot of stuff in Ryan George's pitch meetings where he's informing you about all of the corners that filmmakers cut. That's like how he sets up his jokes and everything, is to point out all this stuff. And there's value to that, to kind of call it out. And it's a way for the average Joe to be informed a little bit about some of these things. And I think that there is a lot of value in that. And then, you know, stuff like I put out a video yesterday on movies that audiences loves and critics hated. You need the critics to be able to call out, you know, Bayformers crap. That it entertained people is totally fine. But there has to be a counterbalance to like him, you know, pandering to the lowest common denominator, but it makes $1 billion. You know, Age of Extinction. Wow. I mean, I'm even biased towards that movie because they filmed all the stuff at Mark Wahlberg's house was filmed about 8 miles that way. And it's not a good movie. It's a very bad, bad film, but it made over $1 billion. And so criticism is kind of a pushback to be like, no, there are movies that can get great reviews and make $3 billion. Endgame did it. Even Avatar got great reviews. Like, there's movies that can do it. And then you have movies that – and I think there is a lot of value in all of that. Real quick, I wanted to touch on – we got more – You got one more?
But before we move on, something was just brought to my attention. So Regal Cinemas has actually sided with AMC against Universal Pictures, stating that we will not be showing movies that fail to respect the theatrical windows, as it does not make any economic sense for us. So
the war has begun.
Better and better.
Let's see. It's, how to make a Yoda joke, Clone Wars Yoda joke out of that one. I don't know how to do it. The Civil War has begun amongst Universal and theater chains. All right, real quick. I don't want to linger on this too long, but this last week was announced that Mission Impossible 1 and 2 or 7 and 8 have been delayed like 3 months. They're supposed to come out summer 21 and 22. They've been pushed back to like November 21 and 22. If you don't know, they announced it over a year ago. Chris McQuarrie is returning, and he's doing the next two Mission Impossible movies back to back, probably because they want to finish out the series with Tom Cruise before he hits 60. And that's not a joke. That's a legitimate thought. It's also kind of funny. Uncharted moved forward a couple months to July 2021. And then Spider-Man 3, actually all the Spider-Man 3 and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse got new release dates, dropping in November 2021, actually on the date that Doctor Strange was originally scheduled for. So like 2 hours after this was announced, then Doctor Strange moved once again. Do you have any new thoughts on any of this? We talk about dates moving every single week.
Yeah.
I don't have much to say.
Right. No, I mean, like, obviously Spider-Man 3 was never going to open like 2 weeks after Venom 2. That's just preposterous. So, yeah, the fact that it moved to Doctor Strange's date and like Doctor Strange moved to like whatever. And it's a little bit of a reshuffling that doesn't surprise me at all. I don't really have much else to add on it.
I'm just going to repeat what I say every week for anyone that's just tuning in for the first time today. But basically what I've been saying ever since all this started is that there's just such a large trickle down effect of all of this that pretty much every movie date is going to shuffle. There will be a couple of exceptions here and there. But if you take 3 months worth of movies and you say they can't come out when they're supposed to and we just have to shuffle them back, you can't just release twice as many movies in the fall of 2020 as you would have otherwise. First off, you just can't do that. You can't put that many movies in the theaters. And then every theater still wants the best release date. And so then it just kind of turns into this kind of big shuffle. And then add to that, movies that are in production right now aren't in production. Movies in post-production, certain ones they can't finish. Or like Minions 2. Mm-hmm. They had to shut down production because of that. And so there's just a big trickle down to where some people are like, do they really think that movie theaters aren't going to be back up and running in late 2021? No, that's not what it is. It's this reshuffling of everything to try and get the best release date for everyone. That's kind of what you're seeing with all of this. And it's not going to stop. They're going to keep I would take even every date. I'm not even saying the dates because I don't think they're going to stick. I don't know which ones. I don't know. But like, it's going to keep shuffling. And even now, like, you have two major theater chains saying we're not going to put out Universal Pictures films anymore. Mm-hmm. And you go, I don't know. I doubt that'll play out. But that has big ramifications if theaters aren't being taken up with if you don't have to worry about Halloween's release date anymore, maybe we could put Venom there again.
That's true.
All this weird stuff that's the trickle down of this insane time that we're in right now. But I don't have any specifics beyond kind of my general. Just assume everything's going to change is my general policy. Got a super chat from Majestic Demon. I went out and bought 1917 yesterday, watched it when I got home, and I'm still picking up the pieces of my mind that were blown away by that film. It's a good one. It was your favorite of last year, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's not only my favorite of last year. I think it's you can make an argument that it's the best war film ever made. So
I think it was my number two of last year. But, you know, if I rewatch that one in Ford v Ferrari, it could be number one. I mean, just pretty incredible.
Yeah.
Pretty incredible what they were able to do with that film. Real quick, super chat from Kevin Hernandez. Trolls World Tour is bad. I hate it. I haven't seen it. I just wasn't interested. A lot of people are like, hey, you know, there's a new Trolls movie. You could rent that one and watch it and review it. And I was like, I'm just not interested in paying $20 to watch a movie at home. I'm not interested in really watching anyway. So that's why I didn't get it. Like, if they had a better option to where I could buy it or something, maybe I would. But it's also one that I'm not like crazy about. Hey, kids, here, watch this movie about farting trolls. They fart rainbows. Yeah, it's cute. Yeah. Like, And the first one, I mean, with like the goblins and stuff were eating the trolls. I mean, it was really pretty dark on some of the stuff with that movie that I just wasn't necessarily the thing for me. Real quick, another super chat on here. Max Bolton says, each Star Wars movie with a grade. I'm not quite sure what you're asking. If you want me to give a letter grade to each Star Wars movie, I've reviewed all of them on my channel. I did that last fall leading up to Rise of Skywalker. And so you can check out my grades on all of them. And I also have rankings that kind of give me how they kind of fall for me. We'll throw this one over to you, Griffin. What's your spectrum on these ones? What's your bottom Star Wars movie and what grade do you give it?
Is that a real question?
Just you real quick. Like, what? Like, is it still Rise of Skywalker? Is that what you're on? Is your worst?
Oh, yeah. It was bad. I'm sorry. I thought you were making a joke. That's why.
I sort of am. Rise set up a controversy.
Rise of Skywalker. That's your easily worst. The worst.
How bad is it on that letter score?
Probably like a D+.
D+. I think mine at worst is.
I think it's terrible.
I think mine was Attack of the Clones, and I had a C. I think is a C.
Yeah,
it's got good sequences, I rewatched it last week, and I mean, the acting is atrocious, the dialogue is atrocious, and I don't think it has a plot. But there's still some Star Wars magic in it.
It still feels more like Star Wars to me than Rise of Skywalker. Let's put it that way.
So moving along, I want to do a little quick editorial here. Little discussion. The movie Extraction came out last week, and we talked about it on the podcast. You gave it a raving review, got me pumped for it.
Yeah.
And I'm the target audience. I'm absolutely the target audience for that one. And I saw it. I stayed up till 2 a.m. to watch it right when it debuted. I never do that. I think it's the only time I've done it with a Netflix film. And I really dug it. And maybe I had some recency bias. Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, I went with an A minus on it because it, like, for me as an action movie, it had that urgency, the momentum, great everything, cool performances. And I like the way it treated kind of side characters and giving them a little bit of, like, random henchmen. Normally in these movies, you don't know anything about them. They're just evil, mean dudes. And these ones, it gave you their different perspective. And then the perspective on the internet, however, has been way more mixed than I was expecting.
Yeah, right? So weird.
Really surprised, not just by how many and the who's, the specific people that were like, oh, sure, it was great action, but it's just a hollow movie with nothing to say and nothing to do. And you don't care about anyone or anything that happened. It's just visual noise. I was like, what? I was really surprised by how many people said that. And I got into a bunch of discussions with people, and I made some tweets about this, towards like, I'm actively confused. It feels to me over the last decade, there's this huge category of people that they will rave about The Raid, Fury Road, and John Wick, and maybe even Taken thrown in the mix there, in every other action movie that's just good, they call it bad. And it seems like a lot of people kind of fall into that category. If you look at – and other people are like, yeah, well, you know, comic book movies are action movies. And so, you know, tons of people give positive reviews to action movies. Like, no. There's a difference between an action movie as it was defined for decades and modern epic mega blockbuster comic book movies. Like, there's a really – there are different types of stories, different types of material. We're talking about an action movie, you know – throw in martial arts, but you throw in guys with guns. But, like, you know what we were talking about when you say action movie versus Endgame. And I just look at it, and every time one of these movies comes out that I know I'm going to be a little bit I'm the target audience, so I'll be softer on some of these ones. An example, in case where you went real negative on it, Gemini Man. One that I saw. And I went, okay, yeah, definitely feels dated. Feels like this is a concept that should have been made in the year 2002. And the script was just lying there. But, you know, I had fun with it. I'm the target audience. And a lot more people just ravage on it, kind of like, worst of the year. And it's like, I don't even know what you're saying right now. And then, or it's ones like this where it's like a movie that some of us are saying is great. And a bunch of people just, it's hollow. There's nothing to it. So I just want to throw that one out there too. You wouldn't be in the category of me that's just a total sucker for the action genre. Do you have any perspective on this one? Do you see kind of this pattern that I'm seeing where it seems like the action movie specifically has become niche? It's become niche.
Yeah.
Where there's literally like five movies, one per year maybe, that people dig, and then everything else is just for the fans.
Yeah, I don't entirely understand like how I guess you can say that John Wick, the first one at least, has more of an emotional core to it than Extraction because of the relationship with his dog and his wife and all of that. And it's like, it's not a lot, but it's enough to really just like get the job done. But the other two don't necessarily have that. I mean, they explore it, you know, no more than like the emotional stuff that's explored in Extraction, which I actually don't think gets enough credit. I think there's like an interesting sort of commentary on there on like role models and like people, you know, father figures and people you look up to for whatever reason, I guess people it didn't convey to them. But like, yeah, from just like a solely like action film standpoint, like I don't really understand why this movie is getting targeted more than like the John Wick films.
Right.
I think
the John Wick films have a world building that makes them it adds some spark to it.
Yeah.
And totally agree with that. But people are like, I was talking with a guy like, what in the script of The Raid adds that extra layer of depth to where we're praising The Raid, but this is this hollow movie? And, you know, the person was like, well, you know, the the raid, it's about, you know, these guys teaming up and you have to fight Mad Dog at the end. It was like, but everything you just said has a counterpart in Extraction. There's nothing like I don't want to give too much away, but there's absolutely bonding for him. There's teaming up to overcome things. So it's not like Mad Dog has a backstory. It's not like these guys have much detail besides there's someone back home. So what in the script of the raid is not hollow? What is the magic that is the raid that it gets a pass? Or the one that's crazy to me is Taken, that people still love the movie Taken. And I don't know if that's just nostalgia that they haven't watched it in 10 years or whatever, but, and I love the movie Taken. I've seen it 30 times. I am I love that movie. But the movie starts off with Brian Mills buying a karaoke machine. And he's like, this karaoke machine, this is the one with the autoplay, right? Yes, you've read the manual a bunch of times. Perfect. I'll take it. And it's overselling him buying a karaoke machine to show he's got a plan for everything. He thinks everything through. And then he goes to his daughter's birthday party and she wants to be a singer and the new stepfather gets her a pony and she's like 25 years old and she's supposed to be playing a 14-year-old or something. And it's like, you're just watching it being like, this is cringe. And then he just happens to be go on a mission to as a bodyguard for a singer and gets her number so that, like, I mean, it's just this stuff that's just goofy as can be.
It's goofy, but I still think I resonate more emotionally to that one than stuff in Extraction. Like, I think the problem when it comes, just to play the other side, I think the problem when it comes to Extraction is like the relationship between the kid and Chris Hemsworth isn't really explored that much. No. I mean, like, the kid is basically like a therapist to Chris Hemsworth for like one scene. But like, we never get more from the kid. And so like, that was my big issue with the film, is I wish that relationship actually felt stronger, because it would have made the action and everything way better. And like, listen, I already like love the movie. So it's just like, I think it's stuff like that where it's like that relationship wasn't developed as enough as it needed to be for this film. That I can kind of see it from that point. But like, even still, when you take that into account, it's an excellent movie. Like, it does what it sets out to do, you know?
Yeah. And I guess my kind of point on some of that is that if you look at the action in Taken versus Extraction, Extraction is much better action. Taken, easily. It's chopped up. This basic plot, just as simple, just as much of kind of a ticking clock. And one of these ones gets all sorts of praise, and one of them, it's a hollow movie. And that's where I just can't get a grasp on what that thing is. What is it that there's some spark in Taken? There's some magic in it. There's some magic in The Raid. There's some magic in Fury Road, John Wick, to where people watch those ones and the plots are just as simple, but praised as can be. And Extraction seems to have not had whatever that magic is. And no one's really quite been able to articulate exactly the distinction. And the frustration for me as a fan of the genre, it just feels like there's no middle. There's only the greats and the bads. And, you know, Screen Rant's running articles, why Extraction is no John Wick. Okay, well, so what? Can we just talk about it?
Is it trying to be? Yeah, you know.
Like, You don't have to follow up Spider-Man Far From Home. Why Spider-Man Far From Home is no Endgame, and it didn't make nearly as much money because of it. Well, that's because Endgame was not – like, everything isn't Endgame. Everything is not John Wick. And that's a very weird standard to use. So just wanted to rant about that a little bit in video form since I
– Yeah, it's – I get it. It's frustrating. It's frustrating.
Want to repeat, Brandon Caterpillar had a super chat bringing this up. Regal reportedly has sided with Universal. Thoughts? We talked about this just a little bit. This might have been actually what you referenced. I just wanted to make sure to say his name on the screen. But as per our original topic, it looks like other theaters, they're probably going to start teaming up. And if Regal teams up with AMC, it would not surprise me at all if you start getting a whole bunch more people teaming up on this one in one direction to – because that's their best tactic on all of this, is to work together. And if all the studios are making big, bold statements, or if all of the theaters are making a big, bold statement together, they can battle any one studio. If all the studios team up together, it gets really interesting at that point in time. All right, let's close out the audio version of this one on here. Any recommendations for what people should check out this weekend?
Yeah, if you haven't, Justin Krazel, who was the director of the version of Macbeth with Michael Fassbender, which, you know, no one saw, and I don't even know if everyone would like it, but it's an amazing adaptation of that, very much like a visual sort of just like mood poem that sounds really pretentious. But and then he also did the Assassin's Creed adaptation, which I'm a big defender of, but the majority of people don't really like it. He has a new film out right now called The True History of the Kelly Gang, and it's really good. It's like this punk rock Australian Western about the most famous outlaw and celebrated figure in Australian history. And so that's available to watch on VOD if you're interested.
And along those same lines, you got to interview him. So if you also want to, like, you talked about why he thought Assassin's Creed failed. So if you guys saw the Assassin's Creed movie and were like, I don't know, I got a lot of problems with this, the director dives into that in this interview you did with him. It also talks about where he would have gone with the sequel. So it was about 10 minutes long. You guys just like having the interesting conversation that you always want to know on these movies. Like, what do they think? How do they analyze all of that? So over on FilmSpeak, Griffin's channel, you can check that out once it's done. If you're on the video version, we're going to keep on talking for a little bit longer and take your questions if you want to start throwing questions down into the chat on here. But thank you guys so much for listening over on the audio version. We'll be back next week to talk about whatever interesting is happening in the world of movies, and keep talking movies too much.